Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Paul, incumbent Senator Mark Begich and Republican challenger Dan Sullivan didn't let the grass grow under their feet. They're off campaigning and they are debating.
I don't think they ever took a breath. Had the first debate on Wednesday with United for Liberty Alaska. It's kind of a right-leaning group with libertarians, I guess, and Republicans and Anchorage Tea Party. So it was a head-to-head. Begich stressed his ability to work across the aisle and be pals with everyone. Dan Sullivan, the GOP nominee, took on his record, went after him on several issues, and tried to tie him to Reid, Harry Reid, and Barack Obama. It's going to be an interesting campaign, I think. These guys are fairly blunt about their dislike kind of shows through. So this is going to be, there's like going to be 10 or 13 of these things.
What do you make of using a whiteboard to ask questions like,
I thought that was unusual.
Do you recognize the state bird? Is this, the purpose, it seems to me, is to throw the candidates off their stump speech.
You take them off their stride, yeah. I don't know. I don't mind that. To me, it's kind of a waste of time. I'd rather know where they are on the real issues, but it's fun sometimes to watch them flounder.
And see if they can spell ptarmigan correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
Steve McDonald, the Division of Elections has revised the election returns. They now report after counting more than 17,000 additional ballots. Some 35% of the voters turned out. Anything to note in the latest election report? And I should add, the returns were updated even after I wrote a note to myself here and to you. So it's almost 36% now.
Yeah, they're chipping away at it a little bit. There was, after Tuesday night's primary, there were about 30 to 33,000 ballots that remained to be counted. There were question ballots, absentee ballots, and like 3,000 early votes that they had to do. And then the other night, they got a big chunk of those done. I think they chipped away at it again the other day.
I think
day.
They also include special needs votes.
I think there's special needs. You're absolutely right. That's in there as well. So as for the overall election picture, nothing's really changed. Nothing's narrowed. Maybe the Proposition 1 has probably widened a little bit the gap there, but the no side is still pretty well entrenched as the leading side. And the U.S. Senate race, same thing there, same percentages for each of the candidates. So nothing's really changed. I think candidates, campaigns have gotten very sophisticated over the years in working question and absentee ballots, especially the absentee ballots. And there's not much you can do really about question ballots if you just mess up. But certainly working hard on the absentee ballots. So they're probably going to break pretty much the same way as the regular votes.
And it turns out that despite the criticism of the turnout, that the Alaska turnout for a primary election in this country this year is going to be better than just about any state.
We're going to be like number two in turnout. Hawaii right now, 41%, and they had to deal with a hurricane as well. They had to postpone voting in one part of the state because of a hurricane. But the turnout in Hawaii so far is tops in the nation for a primary this summer, 41%. Right now, we're number two at like 35-36%. Iowa is last on that list. 9% of the votes of the voters turned out to cast ballots in the primary in Iowa. But I guess there's a little bit of silver lining in the cloud. At least we're number two, but still not great for turnout.
And the little perspective additionally here: California in its primary election, the turnout was about 18%. Tim, the oil tax referendum was decided by about 5% of the voters, maybe a little bit more as things change a little bit. So it was close. Two questions. Does the margin mean anything to the oil industry? And what does the industry do next?
Well, I think, Michael, it should mean something. They spent gobs of money. And the fact that like $15 or $16 million was spent on the no campaign, and they barely mustered a margin. I think it demonstrates that a lot of Alaskans are really split about this thing and split in their attitudes toward the industry. What I think when you look at it from a regional breakdown, though, it makes a little bit more sense. I mean, Anchorage, Mat-Su, Kenai were heavily in the no camp. Southeast, which is mainly public, a lot of public employees in Juneau. Coastal communities were primarily in the yes camp. So the surprise was Fairbanks. Now, I wouldn't be surprised at the university going for yes, but the mainstream Fairbanks was a surprise. I mean, there were, you know, the less the yes-led, and yet Fairbanks is heavily benefited.
Do we have a theory of why?
It's just Fairbanks, I think. And I've lived there, and you've lived there, and it's just Fairbanks. So how do you explain? But just going to your question, though, I think the industry, now the yes people say, well, we have a moral victory. You know, we didn't win, but we came close to winning, and we demonstrated that a lot of people are concerned about this, and the industry has got to now perform. So we'll see what they do. That's what we can read out of it.
Okay.
I think they will do what they said they would do, but we'll see.
We're going to talk some more about oil later in the show. Steve, one more election report, and this was a surprise. The Libertarians nominated a candidate for the U.S. Senate, Tom Walker, and he didn't have a victory speech. He withdrew.
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, his job's going to get in the way of running. I don't know why people don't think of this before they put their name on the ballot. You hear about people, well, you know, I don't know if running for a statewide election is going to be good for my family time. No, it's not going to be at all. And is it going to interfere with my job? Yes, it will interfere with your job. It's a big task running for a statewide election. So Mr. Walker determined that this was not going to be conducive to him showing up for his job on the North Slope, or at least north of the Brooks Range, I think is how it's been described. So the Libertarians had to go with the number two candidate on the list, a fellow by the name of Mark Fish, who's, you know, he's a dyed-in-the-wool Libertarian, been with the party for a long time.
An activist.
I'm sure he'll uphold
what
the Libertarian
about the
policies.
And theory or suggestion that people who voted for Tom Walker thought he was Bill Walker.
Yeah, that's a real good possibility. I think he may have won that. I think the Libertarian Party even believes in that theory itself. I think they've speculated that that may have been the case, and that's the reason why he did as well as he did.
And I'm going to guess here, but it seems to me that tops the Libertarian Party and alternative candidates, the AIP, Alaskan Independence Party, mm-hmm. could think about would maybe like be 5% of the general election vote. What do you think? 6%?
Probably. It's a long way from the days of Dick Randolph. Let's put it that way. In 1982, Dick Randolph ran as a Libertarian in the governor's race, and he did incredibly well. Made the Libertarian Party a bona fide party here in the state of Alaska. 4 years later, he ran as a Republican, and since then the Libertarian Party has kind of slid off the map, and it's a shame. You think when you look at their guiding principles, it pretty well lines
well, it's
a little
up surprising
with a lot of Alaskans
too, now,
feel.
Given the emergence of Rand Paul as a national figure. But maybe they'll have another day here.
Perhaps they will. They need a candidate that they can build the party around, or a couple of candidates. They've had some on the Kenai.
Paul Jenkins, striking NSTAR workers return to work. What's happening?
About 100 of them started striking on August 11th. The main issue is the company's plan to take new employees to a 401k, like the state did.
And many other companies
across the nation. The union wants a continuation of the defined benefit or pension plan. They hashed it out. I guess the company stood its ground. Workers went back to work. The old contract, which expired, is still in effect. Negotiations are going to be renewed. The union says it'll be testifying at things like the RCA rate hearings and things like that. So it's not over yet, but at least the strike part is anyway.
And we do know that in some industries, and I think in some school districts, we've had people working out of contract or an old contract for several years. Okay, Tim. Cook Inlet oil production is up in the last year, and state revenue royalty is up too.
Michael, this is a good news story. Cook Inlet had declined pretty substantially over the years. Small oil fields, old platforms, no new exploration. And a few years ago, the state put some tax credits, some incentives in place, and the company's kind of got with it. New discoveries, new development. A company by the name of Hillcorp Energy came in, bought from older, larger companies, rejuvenated, put a lot of money into the fields, and now the production is up to about 15, 16 million barrels a year, and that is pretty good compared to what it had been. It's double about in the last 10 years. It's just about the last 5 years. It's just about doubled the production of Cook Inlet. It's come down, and it's come back up, and that's good. And of course, along with that, royalties paid to the state have increased also. The royalties have actually increased a bit more because the royalty rates, which were increased on some of the platforms that have been given a break some years back. So it's fortunate. It's a good news story.
And the royalty revenues, they were on some kind of timer that they were going to come back at a certain point? I don't follow that.
It was tied to production, Michael. They were given a break. The platforms were operating under pretty distressed circumstances, so the state was able to, under some legislation that was passed, give them a break. The idea being if they reestablished and they brought the production back up, the royalty would go back up to the original rate. And that's what's happened on a couple. Some are still under the old regime.
Steve, you want to get in here?
Oh, just when Tim said things were down, things were really down. They were to the point where a couple of years ago, companies like Enstar Natural Gas talking about importing natural gas from other places in the world, Australia, British Columbia, Lower 48. That's how low reserves were, and natural gas supplies were so low that here we are, an energy state, and we were looking at the possibility of importing natural gas to meet natural gas demands here in South Central. But things have changed.
Steve, Tim, you follow this very closely. Where are we on natural gas now? I mean, we've had several scares over the last year, and then we've been reassured, scares meaning we've been told that there might not be enough and be prepared. And then we've been told, no, things are getting much, much better. So what's the natural gas situation in Cook Inlet?
Well, the numbers are a little bit hard to, specific numbers are hard to come by, Michael, but basically the utilities have all of their contract mets through 2018 or into the early part of 2018. Hillcorp, which is the major supplier, having invested in bringing these new gas supplies on, says that they have new gas they can sell to extend those contracts. New discoveries are being made, although the new fields are not yet online. Independents have made discoveries, and we have a new platform being built this summer in Cook Inlet by a small independent called Fury. That's good news. Another discovery by Buccaneer Energy, which has got its own set of problems in the southern part of the inlet. So things are looking better. Another interesting thing is you have now companies that are coming in proposing to do gas projects in the Mat-Su, like a Japanese company, REI, wants to build a small LNG plant to serve Japanese customer base. Just past a couple of days, a Houston company has come up with another idea for a small plant that would serve the interior and serve South Central with small LNG shipments.
Now, the Japanese facility is going to be all export?
Yeah. And well, they say if they built theirs, some of their LNG would be available for local sales also.
What are they going to do for a port?
They would build it at Port McKenzie. Okay. Now, not quite on Burl. As I understand, they would build their plant on private land, but they would use facilities near the port, not the port itself. They'd have to build their own dock.
Okay. All right. Paul, police militarization is scrutinized all over the United States as a result of the events in Ferguson, Missouri. And the scrutiny extends, now we learn, to Alaska.
The Obama administration, I guess after Ferguson, after news pictures of police officers with balaclavas and military uniforms on pointing their rifles at crowds and things, got very excited about that and have asked for...
Not to mention those big armored vehicles.
The big armored vehicles, sure. And they've asked for a review of the government's policy of handing those kind of equipment out to local law enforcement. In Alaska, we've got some of it. The troopers have a $500,000 armored personnel carrier, I guess, or armored vehicle that never started, just sat there. And they've got a couple of other armored vehicles they use. And APD has got a couple they've bought. APD has none of this equipment. They've accepted none of it. They've got some grant money for things to do, but they've got their own they bought. And the Department of Public Safety is getting the troopers 120 or so AR-15 rifles, I guess, from the military. All in all, I mean, this has been going on since the 70s and 80s when an outfit called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration was handing out Vietnam-era stuff to police departments all over the country. And it's gone on. It's equipment and grants. How they're handled at the local level is problematic, I suppose, if they're mishandled. As some people will tell you, has happened in Ferguson. Others will argue it wasn't.
But you know what surprises me the most is that when I hear discussion, or particularly criticism of the kinds of vehicles and some of the weapons that have been distributed to police departments, it's from either retired police chiefs or current police chiefs who are members of national organizations themselves, who seem to think that some communities have been seduced by, boy, is this neat
stuff. Is this
stuff.
Cool or what? Yeah. I mean, do you really need a vehicle that was designed to launch rockets? I mean, that's what. On the other hand, you know, just Ferguson has caused this scrutiny, but I'm not sure it's all that justified, all the instances. We've got 105 officers killed last year in the line of duty across the country, 35 of them shot or stabbed. You've got somebody holed up in a house that's got three hostages. Do you want this guy with a sniper rifle, or you just want somebody to go knock on the door? Do you want your officers to roll up there in a car, or would you rather they were in an armored vehicle? These are questions you have to ask. I suppose, I think what bothers people, and what you keep seeing this woman holding a sign in Ferguson, our police shouldn't look like the Army or something. And I think it's more the appearance of the military, mm-hmm. The military look is what bothers people. I don't like to see police officers with balaclavas, because you see that in third world countries. You know, you see that in places where bad things happen and they don't want you to see their faces. But I think we're well beyond the Barney Fife stage in this country. We have people here with very sophisticated weapons and some very bad ideas. And I think the police have to be prepared to protect themselves and us.
One of the things I wonder about this, Paul, is this kind of stuff is very expensive, because and the local police departments in this financial environment are forced to pay for it. And even the Congress itself, when it's constantly looking for places to save money.
Worse, military equipment is designed for a military setting. It needs maintenance, almost constant maintenance. These things are not made we'll build them on Tuesday and never worry about them again. You have to be concerned with them all the time. And that's expensive at the local level. People turn these down. There are many police departments across the country, I was reading this morning, that are trying to send these vehicles back because they can't afford the maintenance. They can't afford to have three guys whose whole job is to fix this truck.
Let's leave it there. Thank you. Tim, oil prices have taken a slide. Alaska North Slope crude is now about $100 a barrel. I believe it was somewhere around 110 earlier this year. Tell us about the market forces and other forces that are shaping this pricing.
Michael, you sort of got to look back and you have a sense of we've been here before. we've seen oil prices go up and down, and this latest slide in prices, though, is a bit of a concern, though, because what seems to be behind it is slack demand. Despite all the turmoil in the Middle East, oil demand is not picking up. There's a lot of supply in the market. You know, the shale oil revolution in the U.S., continental U.S. has just taken everybody by surprise. North Dakota, Texas, there's oil all over the place. Russia's putting out a lot of oil coming on our West Coast market. So prices are sliding down. You know, you can never make predictions on this kind of thing, because they could go back up. But fundamentally, you just can't see anything there that would cause prices to go up. The long-term theory of resource scarcity just doesn't seem to be holding up anymore.
And the fact that demand seems to be down in India and China in particular, which are two of the biggest consumers in the world.
Yeah, and also energy conservation is beginning to be felt too. But I think what's most indicative of people would say that, well, there'd be some event in the Middle East and that will drive prices back up again. And it hasn't happened.
I mean, that what's going on in the Ukraine would be destabilizing and have oil prices going up because of the implications for the United States and Russia.
It hasn't seemed to have any effect at all. But it's important to us because at the same time that prices are dipping a little bit, our production has been declining. Now, hopefully that'll be stabilized now. The producers feel they can do more because of the tax change. And
bring remind us, if we lost $10 off price for a full year, what would that mean to the Alaska Treasury?
I think Michael, I've heard it in context of a dollar drop in the price of crude oil translates these days to about $60 million in loss. I could be wrong, and that may be an old figure, but I've heard that number before. So $10 off, you know.
$600 million in that context.
It's tough to really kind of translate and see what that might mean, but because oil prices are only part of how the revenues are calculated.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Steve McDonald, the Kodiak rocket facility launches a test rocket for the military, and the launch lasts less than 10 seconds.
Yeah, 4 seconds.
What happened?
Something like that. Well, they had to blow it up, the military did, because it started acting erratically. They don't know why. They said it's going to take months of investigation before they figure out what went haywire here and why they had to detonate this rocket. But it was a 48-foot-long rocket. The was going to be launched from the Kodiak rocket site, and it, in the nose cone was a hypersonic glider that is a military test vehicle. Unfortunately, once this thing cleared the tower, got about 4 seconds into the launch, they had to detonate this thing. So it did a lot of damage. Nothing that I totaled the facility by any stretch, but it was a lot of debris laying around from the launch facility that had gotten torn off.
And it immediately raised economic, political questions about the future of the facility.
Right, yeah. And the state has come out and said, well, we did our job. We got the thing off the pad. We got the thing basically clear of the tower, and we did everything right. It was the rocket that went wrong. So the state says, we didn't do anything wrong. We did our job. It's like a $5 million investment into the state launch site.
And Steve, I've been waiting probably my whole career to be able to say this on this show. This is one time where you do need to be a rocket scientist.
You do. Yeah, and it's gonna. Yeah, you do. You do. And it'll take a rocket scientist to figure out, I'm sure, what went wrong with this thing. But it's a rough business, this rocket stuff. So, and this one unfortunately went wrong. But, you know, the state says it did its job, and they're hoping to get more business. They're going to have to do some public relations work probably.
Tim.
I think this is, as I recall, this is only the second failure they've had at Kodiak.
Yes, it is.
They had to blow one up sometime, several years ago, but that one got higher up, and then they had to blow it. This is right off the pad.
Yeah.
Tim, we have a little time here. Why don't you briefly tell us about the latest developments with Shell and its plans for the North Slope. Given all the trouble it's had over the years, they're making the statement we're back or we're staying.
Michael, what's happening? Thursday morning, Shell announced that they were going to be moving two rigs to the Arctic, hopefully by 2015, rather than just one. They're bringing a large drilling vessel, a semi-submersible, up called the Polar Explorer. The previous plan, though, had that rig, it would be on standby, kept on standby at Dutch Harbor. So really the only difference is rather than keeping that rig in Dutch Harbor as a relief rig, in case the drill ship that they had planned to use in the Chukchi got into trouble, they would bring the Polar Explorer up to the Chukchi itself, and they both would drill. So maybe you could look at this as, well, this is a practical solution to, rather than paying for a drill rig sitting in Dutch Harbor, they bring it north. It does enhance safety because it's closer. The two rigs serve each other, and they're closer to each other if there's a problem.
What I couldn't figure out in looking at this, as certainly somebody who's not an expert on this subject, is how much of this was a practical development, how much of this is symbolism to remind people we're not leaving?
It's probably both, Michael. I happen to think probably the practical reasoning weighs out, because I just if you have a rig and you're paying for it, why not just use it? Although it costs money to have it drilling too. The fact that you have two rigs up there does make a statement. On the other hand, It stirs up issues too, because instead of having two rigs, one rig out there and creating noise and things like that that people worry about in the undersea environment, you have two rigs. So I mean, there's kind of a double edge to it too. But I think in the long run, I think Shell is obviously anxious to find out what's there, and the more rigs they could use, the more wells they could drill.
And it's important to remember that at one time earlier in the history of our state and the territory, Shell was really a big player here.
Actually, Shell drilled in the Chukchi Sea before. There were multiple rigs operating in one summer in the early 1990s. No fuss, no problem. They found some oil, not enough at the time. They also, many wells have been drilled in the Beaufort Sea, too.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. We have about a minute left, and I would like to make a brief personal statement. This will be my last appearance on Anchorage Edition. I will no longer host the show. In departing, I would like to thank Alaska Public Media for having me here for more than a decade. I would especially like to thank the studio crew that made the show possible, specifically director John LaFernaise, soundman Scott Bruno, and several generations of men and women behind the camera. I would also like to thank the guests who have appeared over the years, particularly the gentlemen who are with me here today, Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Tim Bradner. They approached the news ever thoughtfully and, when the occasion called for it, with wit. Finally, I would like to thank you, the viewers and listeners. I know you're out there because I have heard from you repeatedly, sometimes with praise, occasionally with criticism, always with interest. I'll be seeing you. I just won't be seeing you here anymore. Goodbye and good luck.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.